If ever an idea whose time has come, it is that of the transition town. All over the world, local communities are realising that if they don't take greater charge of their own production and consumption, then we're all in for a rather unpleasant time as the cost of liquid fuels begins to escalate, as it inevitably must with peak oil now at hand, and our dangerous dependence on hydrocarbons aggravates tensions and forces communities to adapt. The transition town movement seeks to provide ways of exerting local responsibility. And discuss how this is actually done, I'm joined by the co-founder of the Transition Network, Rob Hopkins, who's based in the United Kingdom, and from Waiheke Island, James Samuel, who's the National Coordinator for Transition Towns Aotearoa, and Gabrielle Young, who's active in the movement on Waiheke. I began by asking Rob how the whole Transition Town movement actually got started.
It originated when I was living in Ireland and I was teaching in a town called Kinsale on the coast south of Ireland at a further education college, and I was teaching a course that I had established, which was the first two-year full-time permaculture course that I knew of anywhere at that time. And in 2004, I was given a film called The End of Suburbia, and it turned out that Colin Campbell, who's the kind of grandfather of the peak oil concept, really, lived just up the road. So on the first day of term, my students watched this film, The End of Suburbia, and had a talk from Colin Campbell. And so we had a sort of peak oil baptism by fire, really. And it certainly turned my thinking on its head and turned my life upside down, really, I suppose, looking back. And so I set about with my second-year students trying to design a way that the town of Kinsale could look at peak oil as being an opportunity to do something extraordinary and historic and fantastic rather than an enormous crisis. And it led to something that we called the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan, which was the first time a community had actually designed an intentional pathway down from the energy peak.
I'll come back to Kinsale and other communities in the UK in a moment, but let me bring James Samuel in here. James, we saw The End of Suburbia here too. I mean, it had quite an impact. Was it that got you involved?
That, amongst other films. I spent quite a bit of time researching how the world works and where we are, what the state of the world is in terms of energy and environment and so forth. And I was running the community cinema on Waiheke for a while and bringing some of those films to it. And it was my desire to build some local resilience on the Waiheke community that eventually led me to discover Rob's blog at transitionculture.org and started learning about transition towns. And that was my first introduction. And then I found that Richard Heinberg, another of the peak oil leaders and thinkers, was coming to New Zealand to be the keynote speaker at the Taupo Eco Show in October 07. So I thought, all right, well, I'll get Richard to come to Waiheke and we can launch a transition initiative on Waiheke. Well, it didn't work out because he was super booked and busy, and I ended up going down to the Eco Show in Taupo and facilitating the first transition workshops in New Zealand, and we had 140 people at the first workshop who, interestingly enough, were not really interested particularly in peak oil and climate change because they were already well aware of those issues. But what they were very interested in was, what is this transition towns business? What's it about? And can it work for us in our towns? And that's when it all kicked off in New Zealand.
And Gabrielle, you were introduced to this relatively recently too. I know you've just done a permaculture design course. Is that the ideal way in?
I started before that actually by watching the work that was being done in the local community on Waiheke and being very impressed with the mobilisation and action that I saw happening with local projects in the community, and contacted the people that were involved here, particularly James, and got involved that way. I've subsequently done the permaculture design course, which is one of the key foundations of transition culture.
Rob, it seems to me that this is driven at both ends, both the local and the global, that very much the premises of all of this is climate change and peak oil in particular. and that peak oil it features very strongly in the book that you have put together. But at the same time, there are a whole range of community initiatives which are designed to bring communities together to make people feel more part of a community.
I think there's an interesting point there that actually the balance of information that is offered in the Transition Handbook and generally in communications is probably a relatively small focus of about perhaps 20% focus on the challenges, whereas the other 80% of most of the communications coming through the Transition Network is about the solutions. It's about the examples of what's working. It's about all the different things that people are doing and can do, and that's why I think it's grabbing people's attention and is so attractive.
Why is peak oil so pivotal in all of this? James?
Yeah, well, it's pivotal because if we look at the we look at our extraction curve, if you go back 100 years, we were just beginning in this process, and we've gone on this exponential curve of oil extraction. We're now seeing the effects of extracting a limited resource in extremely fluctuating oil prices. I mean, it went to $150 a barrel less than a year ago. It went down to 30. It's back up to almost 70 this morning. You know, that's what you would expect from, you know, when a resource starts becoming less available. And that's going to have a huge impact because of various things, such as our agriculture, which is hugely built on a fossil fuel base. I mean, I don't know where you're sitting, but I can imagine if you just cast your eye around the room that you're sitting in, there's probably not much in the room that hasn't either been transported by oil, produced by oil, or has, you know, has oil its impact at some level, and that's true of all of our industrialized society.
I'm just looking at my plastic desktop. You're quite right. But Rob, let's look at the world, the world's options at that broader level. And in terms of the loss of, we all accept, I guess, that peak oil is here or hereabouts, and that hydrocarbons are really going to be in short supply. There has to be a transition away from the hydrocarbon economy. I think most thinking people now accept that. There are still divisions of view about climate change and the impacts that all that will have, and I don't want to go into the climate change arguments here because we've got time. But aren't there alternatives in a transitional sense in energy which may well offer the opportunities to carry on pretty much as we are?
I think one of
you go, Rob. Give it.
All yours, Rob.
I think one of the key challenges that peak oil presents, which is a particular challenge associated with oil, is the is liquid fuels for transportation. So, you know, we could stay here all night arguing about the pros and cons of nuclear power or renewables, wind, and this, that, and the other. The key challenge, I think, is what we've already started to see, and it's just the beginning of it, is price volatility in relation to oil. It's not that the price is going to go high and stay high forever next week. We're entering the time of very, very volatile oil prices at a time when we are totally dependent on cheap liquid fuels for the centralized distribution of virtually everything that we need in order to function in our lifestyle at the moment. So here in the UK, for example, in the year 2000, our lorry drivers went on strike, and within 3 days, our supermarkets were almost out of food. We were about a day and a half away from a major, major food crisis in this country. And there is as yet nothing that is ready to roll within the next 5 to 10 years that can pick up that strain. And so really we have entered a time when our degree of oil dependency is our degree of vulnerability.
Aren't we likely simply to see, for other reasons as well, but in order to take up this, you know, fill this gap, this time lag, a kind of semi-permanent recession far lower levels of activity, far lower levels of international transport, and all of that?
Well, that's already what has started to happen. So, I mean, certainly there are a number of experts who argue that actually the price of oil going up to $147 a barrel last July, the world can't function at $147 a barrel, and it's one of the key things that has triggered what we're seeing currently economically. And actually what we're seeing now is falling demand, falling consumption. But then the pattern in the longer term over the next few years that we see is that then if the economy then tries to rally and come back again, then it hits back off that high oil price ceiling again. And we start to bounce backwards and forwards off a ceiling, which is kind of moving down.
And you say that the liquefaction of coal simply won't be able to provide the buffer that we need.
The liquefaction of coal, from a climate perspective, is a pact with the devil, really.
Yeah.
And is the sure way to ensure collective suicide. And, you know, we're certainly around the world seeing people embracing coal, but we really have to, I think, put the hopes of our collective survival from a climate point of view into the negotiations taking part in Copenhagen in December, that actually the liquefaction of coal on any kind of scale is something that really, really doesn't happen.
Gabrielle.
Yes.
How are we going to wean people off their addiction to consumption and try to get beyond the rampant individualism that effectively drives the consumption of most of the world's resources? Where is the turning point? And you're going to say, yes, well, it's a transition down process, I know. But where is the psychological turning point for people on this?
Well, I guess for people, if we look at sort of what's happened with the credit crisis recently, and people have, as a result of the huge sort of financial shocks that have gone on in our world economy, people have realised to a large extent, and I've heard in sort of business circles that I've moved in various places at local government, at government level, etc., people saying, well, this means we're sort of returning to some of the values of the old. And it's really made people take stock and rethink about the way we've organised our world. And people have realised that our period of sort of economic individualism is not one that's going to sustain us in the future. And I think we've started to see lots of sort of community building activities and people thinking about community building for the first time in a long time.
This implies a really massive decentralisation of the way in which we do things.
Yes.
Yes. And in the end, only decentralisation of food production, of various other forms of exchange, really, if that isn't implemented, you're saying, I guess, this won't work.
If you look at our existing system, we've seen in the last year how fragile it is. And you've just heard Rob talk about the fragility of that in terms of the increasing volatility we can expect from things like oil prices, etc. And it's only through building resilience at a local level that we're going to be able to support ourselves better. If you look at, there's a study that was done some time ago in the UK, and it said for every $10 that someone spends at the supermarket, only $14 is going to return to the local community because, you know, that gets banked into Woolworths' bank account and goes away from the community. If $10 is spent on local food initiatives and goes to local growers and those kinds of things, or is spent at the farmers market, $25 will be circulated in the community or returned to that community. So you can, you know, the economic benefits and the benefits to community are quite palpable.
Rob, how do you go about convincing, or do you need even to try the multinational operators that they're the way in which they conduct their businesses is really not sustainable? Are they beginning to realise? Are there signs that Shell Oil, for instance, General Foods, are reaching the point where they realise that they're not going to have too many alternatives in terms of the volumes of food in particular, but other commodities being shipped hither and fro, that simply isn't very sustainable?
People aren't stupid, you know. I mean, they the success of their business really ensures on them thinking these things through. I think the question is whether at the core those business models are actually able to adapt in time. You know, if you look at something like Tesco's, their model is based on very, very long supply chains, cheap liquid fuels for moving everything about, large amounts of refrigeration, large amounts of food being thrown away before it even gets to the customer, big stores, out-of-town stores, often dependent on people driving to them. You know, you can tweak and twiddle those models a certain amount, but, you know, there's not that much you can do, I would think. So, I mean, for me, our focus is really on that many of those models, and not all of them, but certainly those big, very long supply chain, just-in-time models, are so vulnerable that as communities and as countries, I think are really what we need to be doing is investing our energy into a parallel infrastructure of building food around food production, for example, around the concept of a food shed. So trying to put in place what food can be grown in and around our settlements as we can. And it's this idea that comes from ecology about modularity. It's not to say that every community, every settlement is going to be growing its own toothbrushes and making laptop computers out of stinging nettles. You know, but what it's saying is that the things that we can make, the things that we can grow, we should be putting that in place. Because if you go back where I am here in Devon, in the town I live in the 18th century, this town produced the bulk of what it needed. So if the imports stopped for some reason, it could manage. You know, and the analogy I use is that of a cake. You know, then the cake was produced locally, and what was imported were the icing and the cherries on the cake.
Yeah.
Now we've turned that around, and the icing and the cherry on the cake is what we produce locally, and the actual cake itself is imported from wherever in the world we can find it the cheapest. It leaves us hugely vulnerable, and building some kind of a parallel infrastructure is really important. But in that, I think what's vital is that, and what transition I think does very successfully, is to say this is not some kind of hair shirt austerity approach. This is actually the way we present this to local authorities here is to say, look, you set out your aims and your objectives for this area for the next 15 or 20 years, which are economic, you know, you want local businesses to grow, you want skills retraining, you want affordable housing, you want to be meeting the kind of low carbon agenda. Actually, if you try and carry on doing those, with business as usual, and assuming that you're going to do that with out-of-town supermarkets, car industry, this kind of stuff, it's not going to happen. Actually, if you're looking at rebuilding the local economies in such a way that affordable housing is made using local materials, creating a range of other businesses, reskilling people, that's actually what means we're going to meet those needs, not sort of hanging on thinking that business as usual is still going to be possible in an energy context that is going to be very, very different to the present.
How successful you began this process in Totnes, in England. This was a sort of bottom up initiative. How successful has that been as a kind of demonstrator for other communities elsewhere in the world?
I think Totnes kind of suffers a bit from being is very much sort of everybody. There's a lot of pressure on the place to be sort of Shangri-La, really. And it's like anywhere else, you know. There's lots of things that we've put in place that have been very good. We have a something called the Garden Share Scheme here, which has been adopted all over the country now, which is like a dating agency to match up people who want to use land but who don't have any with people who have gardens they can't use anymore. We've got a local currency scheme running here. We've just set up our own community-owned energy company, Totnes Renewable Energy Society. There's lots of different sort of projects and initiatives around the town, and lots of work that kind of goes on under the radar, I think, in terms of network building and relationship building. One of the big projects we're just working on now, which is which is nearly done, is what we call an energy descent plan, which is the 12th step of the 12 steps of transition, which is basically creating a plan B for the community based on the kind of energy scenarios that we're talking about here.
I want to look at some of those in just a moment. I'm talking to Rob Hopkins, James Samuel and Gabrielle Young about transition towns. James, the prospects for this in New Zealand, where we have a relatively centralised distribution system, we have quite active centralisation of the services of government, and many people would say relatively weak administration at the local level. How and what kind of transformation is necessary in the arrangements, the local government arrangements, for instance, in order to make this work well?
Yeah, that's an interesting one because where I'm living on Waiheke, we're currently going through some struggles with the Auckland City Council that are the local governance body for Waiheke.
But this should suit you reasonably well with a community board arrangement with some powers, right?
Well, actually,
no.
I my sense with the proposition of a super city for Auckland is that it's a manifestation of just what you might expect in a time of transition, where you have there's two completely opposite and polarized intentions, and one is an intention to centralize control. And that's what we're seeing in the super city. And at the other side is the very obvious to me and obvious to many need to relocalize in terms of local decisions for local matters.
Yes.
There isn't that you cannot, despite the claims, you cannot get the efficiencies which are suggested by a super city and those that propose it as being the best option. But you can get those efficiencies when you know the people in your local region, you know what the resources are, you've mapped them out. And I mean, we had a classic example. We had speed bumps on a street in our town, and they kept getting changed constantly. And finally, at the last time when they were due to be taken out, there was a quote for, I think it was about $12,000 to take these speed bumps off the road. Some local men got out in the middle of the night and unbolted the things and took them away for nothing. You know, you can't get that sort of efficiency from a super city. I think that it's just kind of a the death throes of a dying system. I mean, you know, have a look at the British parliamentary system right now, which is looking really, really shaky. And at the same time, we're getting wonderful transition towns. Got a wonderful press in the Observer just the other day, which Rob has on his blog on transitionculture.org, that clearly describes the advantages of localized responses to the challenges, because they're too big for government to deal with, and they're too scary for individuals to deal with alone.
Yes.
And this is where the transition culture really starts to kick in. People start to work together to build the solutions. They own the solutions, they design the solutions, and they make them work. You know, I mean, there's examples on Waiheke about around fuel. You know, we've got some people working on producing alcohol as an alternative fuel for running motor vehicles. Very simple conversion, very easy to grow, very easy to make. There's all manner of local initiatives which have to come into play now.
Gabrielle, what functions, in your view, need to be devolved further, or does it matter too much? Does it for a place like Waiheke? I mean, there's a certain amount of local autonomy. Mm. Don't take an awful lot of notice of Auckland City, hopefully. And you can do these things from the bottom up, but what are the constraints when it comes to getting things, some things done, which you need either the city or some other entity to agree to?
I guess I can talk about a couple of things. At the moment, if we look at the way energy is handled in New Zealand, energy tends to be handled in a very centralised way, and we haven't got any good examples yet of community-owned energy development. It's done by the large, several large, you know, corporate government-owned enterprises, etc. And, you know, there's nothing to stop us from having community-owned resources, but we don't have any good examples of that yet.
Is there any prospect of Waiheke ever being relatively independent in terms of energy production, localised energy, distributed energy systems?
There's a great, there's certainly a great example, and it's been in the media quite a bit here, of the island of Samsø in Denmark, where they have completely embraced community-owned, they're an island community like Waiheke, and they've completely embraced local community-owned energy to the point that they now ship energy back to the grid in Denmark via, you know, the use of wind turbines, local heating solutions and so on and so forth. It would be great to see someone like Meridian Energy working with us on, you know, creating community-owned solutions.
James, what's the best way of getting local food production revived? I mean, we see around the country farmers' markets popping up, and people love them for all the right reasons. What's the technique here? How do you get it started?
Great question. People are starting to do it in all sorts of different ways. I mean, it's happening all over the country. I started the first community garden on Waiheke about 4 years ago. There are five of them now. They're not. I don't see a community garden as being a solution for large scale local food production, but it's a really good starting point, and it gets people involved in and appreciating what it takes to grow food.
Yes.
It also gives them an opportunity to have dialogue around what other things are possible. And there's a project which we are well underway with here on the island called community-supported agriculture. Community-supported agriculture is about people coming together to engage directly with farmers. And in our case, we've identified a piece of land that's being gifted to the community for this project. We've found a young and very well-skilled farmer who's able to work the land in a way that is honourable, so it doesn't, you know, it's not using fossil fuels and heavy applications of insecticides and so forth. And we have a trust set up, so this is all underway. We're about to launch into planting this spring to be able to start providing people with boxes of vegetables in this coming summer season. Yeah. We'll also look at getting into meats and eggs and mapping some of the fruit supplies. There's enormous amount of food all across the country that isn't really being utilized, and which could be just simply by mapping it and managing it as virtual orchards. You know, we don't need to have the orchard all in one place. We can, you know, we can have three apple trees over there and another couple over there, and if we simply manage them as though they were all in one place, we can effectively ensure that those trees are properly.
This again raises the whole issue of the local authority. I mean, the local authority owns plots of land, and there's some pressure coming on, I notice, around this country to try to make available common land allotments, whatever you like to call it.
That's right.
And for concentrated use.
Yes.
Rob, let's go back to your garden share. How does that work? Is it entirely bottom up, or do local authorities have a role in this as well?
No, it's entirely bottom up. It's something which is run. It basically takes the woman who coordinates it about an hour or 2 hours a week to manage. And there's now 50 families in the town who are growing food who weren't able to do so before, because here we have, in many towns in the UK, the waiting list for allotments is huge. So in Camden, in London, for example, if you put your name on the allotment list now, you might get one in about 40 years' time.
Mm.
So this is a way of kind of bypassing that. When you look around most towns and cities, you might start thinking, well, there's nowhere to grow food here. But actually, you know, there's loads and loads of space. It's just a way of finding ways to unlock it. So it's basically just something that is run a very small amount of time a week and a very easy to adopt model for other places.
Has the Transition Town initiative really taken hold in the UK? I mean, in your book, the Transition Handbook, there's a list of urban areas ranging in the UK, ranging from Bristol all the way down to hamlets. How successful has it been, and what do you expect in the immediate future?
Well, now in terms of formal places that have got an official "We Are a Transition Initiative" stamp in the UK, there's probably 100-120 places, as you say, ranging from cities down to islands and villages. There's also two local authorities who've voted to become transition local authorities, Somerset and Leicestershire, which involves them supporting the transition initiatives in their area. We've a number of sort of businesses and organisations who are adopting those principles as well. We're starting to get significant interest from local national governments. So we just had the Transition Network's annual kind of conference event last weekend in London, and Ed Miliband, who is the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, was invited to come to the conference as what we call a keynote listener.
Uh-huh.
So he wasn't actually invited to come and speak. He was invited to come along and just participate and listen.
Did he come?
He did, yeah. He came and he stayed for a long time, and I think was quite taken with the whole thing, really. And we're starting to get that kind of interest from national government. As James said earlier on, there was an article in the paper on Monday here which was really talking about looking at transition as being a key ingredient in the sort of rethinking of politics here.
There's
something I think very powerful about transition that a lot of people are seeing as across the country now in terms of the interest. And there's many, there's the 100 and so formal ones, but there's also what we call mullers, the ones who are mulling whether to become transition projects or not.
Yeah.
And there's every week we hear of dozens of new ones across the UK.
All right, James, you're busting to come in there and tell us about how well we're doing here.
Well, no, I was actually going to say that relative to the UK, the Transition Handbook was the fifth most popular book in the MP's reading list last summer. I mean, so, that's it.
Mm. That does tell you something. How many transition towns have we got so far in New Zealand?
I think there's about 9 at the moment. Yeah, there's 9 official, and I counted this morning there were 55 listed on tt.org.nz website.
Before we finish, let me come back to you, Rob. The 12 steps that are involved in setting up a transition community, what are they? Off the top of your head.
Yeah, talk about putting me on the spot now. I've got to try and remember them all. Okay, so basically, the idea of the 12 steps is that they're like there is a similarity to the whole kind of addictions thing in a sense, in that it is actually about looking at how do we move away from that dependency, and the steps are something that emerge from a lot of people saying, how do you do that? What are you doing? And so the first one is called Form a Steering Group and Design Its Demise from the Outset, which is about getting a group of people together around you who are similarly inspired and enthused to get this started. The next one is about awareness raising, finding creative, positive, inspiring ways of presenting these ideas that don't make everybody want to jump off a cliff but make them want to run out and start doing something. And we've lots of tools for how you do that. Then there's what laying the foundations, which is about networking with all the organizations and groups and things that are already in your community. It's not like your transition group will be the first thing that ever thought a green thought in the history of the town. The next one is when you get to a stage where you feel there's a kind of a critical mass, is to organize what we call an unleashing, which is the event that is like a launch event, and it's when the evening that people will look back to historically at the point where it all started.
This is a sort of psychological mobilization.
Yeah. And then there's about forming groups. So you draw together people who are passionate about food, about energy, because the thing that drives this process isn't people feeling frightened. It's about people harnessing what it is that they feel really, really passionate and enthusiastic about.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is open space, using open space, which is a really good tool for bringing large groups of people together in a community to come up with ideas. The next one is about developing visible manifestations of the project, so things, practical things start to emerge, tree plantings, local currencies, local food directories, a whole range of different things, that you actually start making things happen on the ground.
The local currency is a form of barter, right?
Well, there's various forms of it. The version that we have is like a printed currency that has the value of a national currency, but which can't leave.
Yes.
It only can cycle locally.
Yes. Yeah, interesting.
The next one is called about the great reskilling. It's the idea of retraining people. I think in many ways we've now become the most useless generation that has ever walked the planet in terms of the skills that we've just discarded, thinking we didn't need them anymore. So there's a whole area there about reskilling.
Yep.
The ninth one is about working with your local government, building a bridge to local government. When you've already got a head of steam behind you, you start working with them. 10 is about honouring the elders, so that's oral history. We do a lot of oral history work. For, I was born in 1968. I have no first-hand recollection of life before cheap oil making everything very easy for us. But we go back two generations from there, and those memories are still there. We can learn a lot from that. 11 is let it go where it wants to go, which is that once you start this process and you have a momentum behind it and an energy behind it, all sorts of extraordinary things will start happening that you had no idea would happen. And it's about stepping back and allowing that to happen. And then the last one is creating an energy descent plan, which is basically creating a plan B for the community, which is based on more realistic assumptions than our local authorities use, who still sit down to plan for the next 20 years of our lives, assuming that in 20 years we'll have a larger economy, a stronger economy, more houses, more cars, and more cheap oil than we have today.
Yes, and thanks to my guest, the co-founder of the Transition Network, Rob Hopkins from the UK, James Samuel, who's the National Coordinator for Transition Towns Aotearoa, and Gabrielle Young, who's active in the transition movement on Waiheke Island. And the Transition Handbook by Rob Hopkins is published by Finch Publishing.